the darkest periods in my career. People who wrote to me at that time would probably call out some pretty poor management style. I've never spoken to anyone about some of this stuff.
Conversations, radio people in their own words. Alone. Clive Dickens.
Just a typical suburban boy, growing up in the Northern Home Counties and sort of finding my way, like I'm sure we all do. My family was full of quite traditional, public service, skilled. You know, my father was an extremely senior policeman in Scotland Yard and in what's called the Regional Crime Squad. And they didn't have small lives. They had very big lives, but they had lives, which careers that were next to no overlap with what was my passion. Relatively quiet. I think I wasn't, you know, there was definitely not the sort of life and soul of the party. You know, some of the other kids had chopper bikes and were pretending to be Evel Knievel. You can pretty much work out what sort of time of life I was growing up in. I was more likely to be the person sort of organising the event or maybe even holding up the ramp as the kids came down the hill towards the bike to do the Evel Knievel jump. But I also wasn't the quiet one either. I wasn't the one that sat out. And so sort of like really, really, I'd say right in the middle, you know, middle of all the school grades, the only thing that I really remember being a little bit different is that I was very keen to get involved in school plays. Sometimes that involved being on the stage, but it was just as more likely being involved in sound and lighting at school. My school was in St Albans in England, and my choir teacher was, I think, to be honest, having an affair with a producer at Radio 4. And that's probably a terrible thing to acknowledge, but I'm pretty sure that was the case.
Hello, schools. Page 10.
We got invited to go and participate in school's radio programmes at BBC Radio 4 for two or three summers.
Now, we learnt this last week.
And we used to go on a coach from St Albans to Broadcasting House. I was trying to work it out last night. It would have been under 10 every Saturday for two summers. And I got paid 50 pence to go and sing in the sub-basement studio of BH. And I remember thinking, wow, this is completely different. And I remember particularly thinking that one day I felt a bit lightheaded and I got travel sick. And I mentioned to my choir mistress that I didn't feel too good. So she said, well, go and sit in the control room. And they sat me down in the back of the control room. They gave me a BBC white paper cup with BBC branding on it and gave me a cup of water. And I thought, this is where I want to be. I don't want to be singing time and tune and singing together for school's programs. I want to be in the control room at a radio station. And I just happened to have been at the very pinnacle at that very early age as a guest on a Radio 4 children's program. And from that moment, you know, that was really what I wanted to do. I'd got this interest in broadcasting, and this was in the 70s, and the only broadcasting that existed in the 70s was BBC and Big City. And I grew up within the sort of catchment of LBC and Capital, and I became obsessive about listening to both stations. I'd listen to LBC at night with my transistor radio under the pillow, like most people of our age at that time. And I'd listen to Roger Scott and Kenny Everett on Capital, Hubble London Child.
Harry Nilsson from 1968 and together. 2 minutes until 1 o'clock, and Rog, you've got 30 seconds to cram in something if you so desire.
John Webley offers us a tenner if we can make this announcement. John Webley will be at the Oak Hill Tavern, Beckenham in Kent.
I was very fortunate to be on the Red Bus line into London, so you know, you'd go into London, get into reception at Capital, and maybe even try and find LBC, which I think in those days was around the back of Fleet Street. And my parents said, well, if you really want to go into radio, you're going to have to go and live abroad because there just isn't enough radio stations here. So we looked at sort of whether I could go and live with my auntie in Canada. Toronto had a very vibrant radio scene. And I thought, well, let's get a college there and maybe study some sort of media there. And looking at all these wonderful options, my parents were brilliantly supportive. And then My father came home from work one day and said, actually, you could go and volunteer at a thing called Hospital Radio. And our hospital had a pretty good hospital radio station called City Radio. And so I went down one Sunday to volunteer to take part in the bingo. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. There's two studios, there's a record library, there's someone who's pretending to be the boss. And I was the only person under the age of about 30, I think. And whilst at Hospital Radio, I looked on the cork board in the room, and there was an advert for the new local radio station that was just about to have its license awarded.
It's Thursday the 15th of October 1981, and your new local radio station is born. Chiltern Radio, serving Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire and Buckinghamshire.
I was a massive Watford fan, so my other passion at that time was going to see Elton John's Tailor-Made Army at Vicarage Road in Watford. My father used to get tickets about once a quarter to go and sit in the press box. And I sat in the press box with my scarf and my bobble hat on. And these were in the days when Watford were flying high. And Elton John was in the press box with me. And I was young and he was the owner of the club. And Watford scored a hat trick, and everyone else everyone in the director's box sort of clapped and iced up and cheered, and Elton John looked around and gave me the thumbs up. And in the half time, I met the then sports reporter who was the voice of Watford, a legendary local radio broadcaster called Mike Vince, who would do the second half commentary of Watford on the Chiltern Radio Sports Show. And he said, well, if Elton's given you a thumbs up, you should come and have a look around the studio. So a couple of Saturdays later, I went up there. The sports show was like one of those classic local radio sports shows. It was on for 5 hours. It covered everything from rugby through to footy. And then just by coincidence, the guy who was the host and producer of the sports show just happened to be a former policeman. So therefore, I had this sort of conversation where, oh, what does your parents do, policeman? And once you just get that connection, the host was a guy called Nigel King. And he said, well, look, we're actually looking for someone to volunteer on the sports show. Would you like to come back and make the tea, move the CFAX TVs around so we can get the score, bring in the telex scores? Can't pay you anything, but would you like to do it? And I said, absolutely. He says, well, of course, the only problem with this is that you won't be able to watch your beloved Watford again. And without hesitation, I went, nope, I'll be here on a Saturday. And I worked up my way up from there. And for the first period of time, I was paying, I remember, about £3 on a bus. And it was taking an hour and a half each way to get there. And my mum was saying, oh, they're not paying anything. They're not even paying your bus fare. You really should think about getting a job in a supermarket like all your friends. And then slowly but surely, I started picking up just small bits of work, tape reclaiming. People listening to this will know that reclaiming reel-to-reel tape was not just environmentally better, but original tapes were hard to come by and very expensive, and the engineering company used to lock them away, so I used to reclaim. And bulk erasing carts, I found a blank invoice in the program controller's office, and I started just putting some monetary value against them. And I remember going to the program controller's secretary. I said, okay, but I've written down all of the 40 things I've done. Do you not think that those were worthy of some money? And she looked down and he looked down and said, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. We should pay you for that. We should pay you for that. And then I was off. And so I worked out then how to get in the system. And by the time I left 11 years later, I was the group program controller, which was a fantastic opportunity. And during those 11 years, I worked with an incredible number of super talented people, because Chiltern was so close to London, it used to attract fantastic talent, particularly on the air. So in that 11 years, I worked very closely with Paul McKenna. And I was with Paul on the first ever time he interviewed and then hypnotist, and decided that he wanted to learn hypnotism. And we worked really closely together for a number of years. And he taught me a lot around visualizing what you want to happen as a big indicator, an influencer of of making things happen. One of the techniques that Paul told me is that we, in our lives, we have a lot of crossroads. They can be moments in our life, personal, family, career. And we move through our life as a journey, and And most people train themselves out of visualizing those crossroads. And at the crossroads, we have to make decisions. And he said the secret to a happy life was noticing when the crossroads were and visualizing them, and then deciding to pause when you reach one of those crossroads in life, deciding whether you go left or right, or whether you go, no, I'm going to carry on. And most people, in his opinion, just carried on doing what they did and either didn't see the crossroads or definitely didn't take the choices. And that's how I visualize the sort of the next step of my career. And, you know, if we're really going there, then probably the next step of each part of my life. All you need to know, music and news for you, Chiltern 362. So it was founded by a group of local shareholders and an incredibly entrepreneurial pioneer called Colin Mason. But I think this story is pretty common of most local radio stations in Great Britain in the time. Single station, he had this vision for a radio station that would be in the north of London area, in the Chilterns. Successfully won the first license for Luton and Dunstable and Bedford. And then over the subsequent 10 or 12 years, he either won more licenses with us, which was like Milton Keynes, or started to acquire underperforming radio stations, which was North Ants Radio in Northampton, Seven Sound in Gloucester, FTP in Bristol.
The Hot FM. Rock Lightning.
The Hot FM was that original idea where you could create a sub-brand that would actually allow you to network stations together. So by 1992, we had about 11 stations and we were doing local breakfast shows only and networking everything from 10 a.m. Now, at that time, there was no rules stopping networking because it was never considered to be technically possible. But in fact, the Radio Authority then introduced rules that actually prohibited it, and you had to have then 12 to 14 hours a day of local programming. But Chiltern was already down to 4 hours a day by about 1992, and my passion for technology plus my passion for music was being combined at a very early age. And way before the internet, I was getting exposed to technology and how technology could actually make radio more efficiently.
Oh, it's a nice summertime oldie from Sister Sledge. I'm in love on the station that just spoils you rotten. Yes, Chiltern 97.
By the time we got to the 1990s, Capital was acquiring aggressively under Richard Eyre's leadership. Capital owned 20% of Chiltern. I think there was a time when Capital owned 20% of nearly every radio group in the UK, because it was pretty much the only station making any material profits, I think, by the early 90s. I could see this happening. I could see Capital's advancement. I'd worked with some fantastic broadcasters that had gone on to work at Radio 1. And I decided to not stick around to watch this locally owned group be consumed by one of these other groups. And I met Richard. I actually met Richard for the first time, Richard Park, for the first time at a conference in London. I didn't know that Richard was in the audience at this conference, and he came up to me and said, oh, come and have a conversation. And he said, come up to Birmingham and have a conversation. I went, Birmingham, right. Yeah, we just bought Midlands Radio. And so I met him in a hotel in Birmingham. We sat down and talked. And he said, I'd like to come and be the program controller of the soon-to-be relaunched BRMB here in Birmingham. Tell me about his plans, about he wanted to bring back Les Ross onto FM because Les was on Extra.
Occupation. Well, I haven't got a job, actually.
Oh,
I just keep turning up here every morning to fill in time till the job centre over the road opens.
Well, and your chosen subject...
I wanted to sort of reignite what was then the very successful Capital Music Festival into a series of events. Richard was group program control of Capital, and Capital had, at that point, this was their first, if I 100% owned investment outside of London. He don't know how many years he'd been there at that point. I think he'd probably been there 5 or 6 years at that point from Clyde and had an incredibly successful run. He was already legendary. you know, incredibly striking figure, incredibly confident, but probably most inspiring of all was just his passion and knowledge and his feeling for what the audience would want. And, you know, he was immersed himself in the Birmingham culture for months, pretty much moved there, and night and day would go out talking to businesses, you know, restaurants, or inevitably clubs and pubs, and talking to what must have been thousands of Brummies about what had happened to their radio station. And we'd go out and he'd say, look at this shop here, you know, they've got Radio 1 on, and, you know, I've spoken to the owner and they switched away from BRMB 4 years ago and Les Ross moved. He would have a huge feeling for the market based on asking people. And of course, there was a playbook. The playbook of Capital London was likely to have some relevance.
When it was time to relaunch BRMB in Birmingham, we needed a fresh, original and well-produced ID package. The Dallas sound was tiring with many years of overuse. So we opted for the sound of Los Angeles, and who did that music? Back then, we were lying fourth in the marketplace. 1 year on, we're top of the tables. What more can I say?
96.4 FM, BRMB.
There was a huge recession again in 1993, and we'd spent a lot of money to buy the station, a lot of money to position the station. It wasn't making much money. And I remember talking to Richard Eyre and saying, look, Clive, this is all very well and good what you and Richard are doing, but we bought a radio station that was making X amount of million, and we've now got a radio station that's making less than half of that. Yeah, I know that you're telling me that more people are either listening or going to be listening, but at the moment, all I know is that we've destroyed the earnings. So it better bloody work. And there were some pretty hairy moments when you sort of thought, okay, well, have we invested too much in this relatively small city compared to what Capital was doing? There were quite a number of moments in that period when I almost crashed that car. Not literally, but, you know, figuratively. It was quite a humbling period, because I'm pretty sure that people who worked with me at that time would probably call out some pretty poor management style issues. Ultimately, everything turned out well and went well, but you get to my age now and you reflect and go, okay, but what were some of the costs in that, in terms of the relationships and some of the ways that could have been done better? And as you get older, hopefully you can reflect more and learn from those mistakes. And that period of BRMB in Capital, although very successful, there was definitely some moments when I look back and would say, actually, there's probably a different way I would have done things, knowing what I know now.
96.4 FM, BRMB.
So Birmingham, actually, by 95, had actually turned around, was financially much more profitable. Les Ross was firing, Birthday Banzo was working, the music position was great, party in the square, party in the park. And the Capital Board decided to keep going, and they acquired Southern Radio, and then they acquired Invicta Radio. And Rich said, look, I need you to do what you've done in Birmingham, but I need you to do it for the group, including London, and come down and be group head of programs, predominantly the music at Capital. I'll do the schedule at Capital because of the relationships I have with the presenters, but you do the music for Capital with me. One of his greatest skills, way before music research, was picking when a song would become a recurrent, right? So you smash out a song, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 times a week. That song would, what we now call, get burnt. And this was pre-music research. He would know when it was getting burnt and he'd rest it. And then most people would then leave it, you know, way too long before they played again, because radio stations were obsessed with new music and the audience weren't always obsessed with new music as much as music programmers. So I relocated back from Birmingham into London and spent my life on the road from across Kent, Sussex, Hampshire, Power FM, right through to Red Dragon. And these stations, one by one, were all effectively relaunched. And Capital was moving into becoming an entertainment group. It started to evolve into Capital Interactive, and a very good friend of mine called Douglas McCallum was the first webmaster of Capital Interactive. And in addition to looking after Capital's music and the events and the regional programs, I got more and more involved in Capital Interactive and understanding more and more about how the internet was going to change everything. And I learned most of that from Doug. And we went from having Doug as employee number one to having a team of about 100. And I thought, right, this is actually what I want to do. I want to get more and more involved in digital media. Capital also then started to grow into the ill-fated hospitality industry. They launched the Capital Cafe in Leicester Square, which actually for the first 12 months was extremely successful, had queues every day. They then decided to go and expand and buy a whole restaurant group. None of the others were successful, and it was a very, very challenging period in Capital's history. And that sort of heralded the end of that high-flying Capital era, where they'd spent over £50 million on building this restaurant empire. Richard Eyre stepped aside to go and work at ITV. David Mansfield came in and said, no, enough of all these restaurants. We just need to go back to radio and acquire more radio assets. Okay, so now the opportunity is to go and do this all over again for the third time, but it's going to be in Scotland, northeast and northwest. Or shall I do something different? And Richard and I had a conversation, and we both agreed that it was really time to do something different. And I faced one of those crossroads. I thought, no, I now need to follow this passion around Capital Interactive and digital media. I'm going to step out and do my own thing. And that was a very big decision, very big moment. I decided that I'd become over-reliant on radio, in my opinion, from a career perspective. I'd become over-reliant on my career in the UK. And therefore, I wanted to travel, and I wanted to not just radio. And that took me to work. I worked in startup of a joint venture with Phil Dowes called Absolute and Dowes, and we worked in North American music radio stations, worked at KLOS in Los Angeles, worked at WTMX in Chicago, worked at PLJ with Scott Shannon in New York.
95.5 PLJ, Shannon in the morning, Scott and Todd at 9:24, Gnarly and Joey on the way back from Farmingdale, Long Island.
And we were doing fly-in, fly-outs, is what we say here in Australia, work in North America, and we had a North American LLC entity that Phil and I set up, which was fantastic. I worked in India at Radio Mirchi in India, helped them establish the Radio Mirchi brand, which is the biggest radio network in India today. I worked in right across Europe, in pretty much every single European country. Actually, never worked in France. One of the reasons for that is that French radio was some of the most advanced radio in the world already. So a lot of what Global has done today is very much modeled on what NRJ and Fun Radio and RTL have been doing in the 90s. And Richard used to talk about how the French model was the perfect model, and that's really the global playbook that's been based on France. So that took me into lots of different radio markets, including Africa and Hungary and Austria and Germany and Poland. And then I also wanted to broaden my experience in digital media, so I got involved in startups. So the first startup that I ever got involved in was a then small London-based company called Shazam. Chris Barton, who is the co-founder of Shazam, had read an article I'd written in Music Week about how streaming media and the mobile phone was going to be, in my opinion, going to be a key important component of the future music industry, and how we were going to stream all our songs, not own them, and how I envisaged a world where we could have lots of titles on a pocket device that was similar to our mobile phone. And he phoned me up and said, well, can you come up and have a look at something I've built with some business partners? And I went up to this little dingy office in Soho in London, and they flipped open a laptop and they held up my Nokia phone, you know, whatever it was, a 6310 or something. They played Money by Pink Floyd off a real music player on a laptop, held up my phone to the speaker, and then all of a sudden, after about 10 seconds, a premium SMS arrived in my inbox, and it said Money by Pink Floyd. Money. And I was, like, amazed. It was like magic. How did this happen? this quiet guy in the corner of the room, whose name's Avery Wang, who's the chief scientist from Shazam and is now on the senior management team at Apple, since when Apple acquired Shazam a couple of years ago.
Trying to solve a problem from first principles, you look at what you have and where you want to go and basically ignore everything else. So it occurred to me.
I said, how does it work? He said, it's an algorithm. And I said, where did you get it? And he goes, what do you mean, where did we get it? I wrote it. It can identify up to 10 million songs in 10 seconds. And I was like, wow, this changed everything. And we need two things. We need to work with radio stations to get them to promote Shazam, and we need to work with record companies to build the database, because we can't survive off the 27 titles that we've got here on the laptop. We need to build a database. And I said, well, I can definitely help you with those two things. And I spent two incredibly enjoyable years helping Shazam get established, building that database, helping them find staff. And, you know, Shazam then turned out to be, you know, one of the most successful British technology startups, and was acquired by Apple a couple of years ago. And, you know, thinking back, another big decision around doing that, I mean, they didn't have any money. Shazam had no money. And I said, we can't pay you, but we can give you some of these valueless shares for your time. And I said, okay, well, you know, that's annoying because I quite like to earn a little bit of money for this, but give me some of those valueless shares then. And we won't say anything more about it. And of course, X many years later, those shares were no longer valueless when Apple acquired that business off the then shareholders. And I was very lucky to be a shareholder for all of those near 20 years. It was a long journey, and there was quite a few moments in the Shazam story that were setbacks, where Shazam almost went under on a number of occasions, ran out of money. But it was yet again, you know, the combination of understanding a bit about music and having contacts in the music industry and meant to build lifelong relationships around the Shazam team. And any radio person working in 90s and early noughties commercial radio would know that every receptionist at the time would spend half their day taking calls from people saying, we were just having this argument in the office. There was a song you played at 20 past 7. Can you tell us what it was?
You know when you don't know what song is playing and it's driving you crazy? With the Shazam app from the App Store, you just hold up your iPhone to the song.
During that period of 2000-2007, pre-Absolute, we started to think about how we could get back into UK commercial radio. The Radio Authority was starting to think about new license areas. I got together with a former colleague from Capital, my now business partner, Donna O'Driscoll, and we formed a joint venture with UTV out of Belfast and Eurocast out of Germany. We believed that UK radio needed to diversify its ownership away from just British groups, and worked very closely with Scott Taunton and John McCann at UTV, and Rainer Pullman and Beata Apple from Eurocast. You know, actually, the Irish radio influence and the German radio influence ended up being very influential over our British radio industry. But we were just doing it to bring in fresh ideas, fresh people, and obviously equity into the market. So we formed Absolute Radio UK as a investment firm and started to apply for new licenses. Quite honestly, it didn't go very well. You know, we had a number of brands that we tried. We had a brand called Jump FM, which was like a hybrid sort of pop dance and pop rock brand. We had a brand called My FM and Go FM. And we spent a lot of time and quite a lot of money trying to convince the Radio Authority that we were a great operator and we should be awarded some licenses to build a new voice in radio. And, you know, still to this day, I sort of wonder what we didn't get right about that, because we had fantastic shareholders, really, really good mixture of international broadcasters, not venture capital firms that were going to flick these licenses. But we just couldn't get our ideas away. So we decided that we needed to own a business. And the first business that we acquired was Deuce FM in Liverpool. And we thought, okay, this will now help. We're not just trying to apply for licenses. We're now an owner. I moved to Liverpool, spent 2 years there. I deployed lots of this technology ideas. I was in Liverpool 2005.
Biggest weekend in Liverpool.
Mark Simon's house party. Live and exclusive to Juice FM.
Liverpool went really, really well. Hugely successful period. By the time we left, we'd actually taken a huge amount of share off Radio City, and we were number one in the under 24 demo, 15-24s, which, you know, not enough to make a ton of money, but we'd sort of won that younger position. But and we still, even with successful Juice Liverpool, we still couldn't convince the radio authority to award us any licenses. So we had a sort of pretty much a come to Jesus moment. It was like, okay, this isn't working, guys. You know, this has now been 2-3 years. We've invested a lot of money in these bids. We bought a station. We need to regroup. And UTV said, look, we really want to do this on our own now. We don't want to be 30%. We're going to buy the wireless group. And I said, look, that's fantastic. You should go and do that. And UTV, by the way, were big radio owners in Ireland. So they knew how to run the radio. They didn't need us. And they obviously ended up buying the wireless group and did extremely well under Scott Taunton's leadership. Eurocast said, look, we really love the UK, but we're owned by a lot of German radio stations. We're going to focus on mainland Europe now. And then Donna and Adrian and myself said, well, we actually want to keep going. We think that we will win a license, but we respect the fact that you don't want to. So let's sell Liverpool to UTV as part of their strategy. Let's get Eurocast its money back. And in AIR, I can go alone. And we signed all that agreement. And I think I can't remember how long it was after that, but quite a short period after that, we decided to use those proceeds to acquire underperforming local radio station in Oxford, England, that was called Passion. And I said, well, you know, we need to have a base. Let's acquire that. And there's going to be a second FM awarded. And I think we could make a strong argument that it's not economically viable to have two owners in addition to Fox. And that's exactly what happened. And we won the license, and we completely threw out all of the jump, all of the my, all of the go ideas, and went into an established radio brand, and did a licensing deal with the Jack brand out of Canada, and said, okay, we need to do something where we've got no one believes our Jump FM, Go FM, My FM story, so we've got to go into an existing story. And I don't know whether that was the reason, but we won that license, and we had, therefore, we had two FMs in Oxford, and we were off.
Jack's the new kid in town, so we don't know all the rules yet. But rest assured, when we do, chances are we'll break them. Because Jack's not like any other radio station you've heard before. First off, we're proud our CD collection includes a whole bunch of cheesy stuff. We don't pretend to play requests. We play whatever we want.
And at the same time, a little bit of success builds confidence, having, you know, invested a lot of time and money not winning any licenses. Then we had a very small business and we were launching Jack in Oxford, and the EMAP businesses came up for sale, and we said, look, let's throw our hat in the ring. Ridiculously large acquisition for our three individuals, but let's see what we can do. And what I learned in that period is that actually the larger the deal, the more likely you can raise money, because the people who advise you on raising the money get paid decent amount of fees. So therefore you get very, very bright, well-connected people. Sometimes raising smaller amounts of money, people are just not interested in, because people don't make much money out of lending you or small amounts of money. So we actually got quite a way through that EMAP process, raised quite a lot of money, hundreds of millions, and didn't succeed, obviously, because the Bauer family, who had owned magazines in the UK and in Germany and had one or two radio stations, outbid us. And I remember talking to Dee in the Lazard's investment room, and she was saying, oh, you know, we'd had our presentation and a few people had come in before us and afterwards. She goes, oh, yeah, there was a really interesting presentation to a German family that just before you, and they were fascinating, but I'm not sure how dedicated they are in buying our business, but let's see. And of course, bang, that fascinating German family were hugely interested in buying that business, and they succeeded. But because we'd had the taste of the bigger deal and we'd successfully raised some money pending a transaction, the next opportunity was Scottish Media Group wanted to dispose of the then Virgin Radio. So we were sort of, let's put an offer in to see whether we can acquire Virgin Radio. And Virgin Radio was always a pretty successful business, as you recall. But post the Chris Evans era had been sort of, because SMG had paid so much money for it, in hindsight, they were just really wanted it to produce cash. A bit like going back to BRMB in 1993 and Richard Eyre, you know, berating me for destroying the earnings of his investment. And I think SMG wanted it to be and it had been a very successful cash operation for them, but they obviously needed to pay down some debt. So we then found ourselves in competition with our former partners in UTV to acquire it. And some of our UK, that was in 2007-08, right at the beginning of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac crisis, subprime crisis in America. And looking back, it was terrible timing because the world was falling out of financial markets. All of our funding disappeared. And as one last gasp attempt, Donna said, well, why don't we pick up the phone to our former colleagues in India and see whether they would be interested in financing this deal. And much to our surprise, they said, jump on a flight tomorrow, come and talk to the board. It's a Saturday, and tell us what you were thinking. And the rest is history, as they say. Summer on Virgin, Virgin Radio. We were very adamant from the start that we felt that the business, although that we had a huge admiration for the Virgin brand, we didn't feel that we could operate a business under the Virgin Radio brand. Contrary to what's often reported, it was 100% our decision from the get-go to decide to rebrand that station. Some other people, for some reason, are under the impression that Virgin Enterprises made that decision for us. That wasn't the case at all. And as I say, huge admirer of the Virgin brand. I'm still a loyal Virgin user today. We felt that there was an opportunity to do something completely. And of course, I'm biased, and it's 12 years later, and Absolute Radio has a huge, vast audience, and I think the Absolute brand is an extremely valuable brand. But of course, things didn't go to plan. First of all, they said, well, if you don't want our brand, you've got to debrand in 100 days. If you don't debrand fully in 100 days, we will enact certain pretty onerous clauses in the contract. So we had to literally remove every element of the brand. And that might seem fine when you're talking about an audio brand and a building, but Virgin had an extremely popular website and had literally tens of thousands of images on the site with the Virgin brand on it. The genius that is Anthony Abbott, who's still working today at Bauer, came to me and said, oh, the bad news is part of this rebrand to the new brand, we've got to get rid of all these images. So can I have approval to hire 10 people for 10 weeks to go and go through the CMS and take all these images down? And I said, that's not going to work. You know, we can't just have 10 people for 10 weeks doing this. There must be a better way. And about an hour and a half later, he came rushing back to me. He goes, actually, we've thought of a better way. We're going to write us what's called a script. We're going to serve it up on the website. And we're going to ask our website visitors to actually moderate the image for us. So you go onto the site, you volunteer to debrand the station, and you get served up a bunch of images, and you have to say, is there a Virgin here? Yes, no. And if you can see a Virgin logo on the image, you say yes, and it goes off into a pot. And if an image gets moderated by two or three people the same way, we'll take that as fact and we'll use this script. And I said, that's a brilliant idea. Then we'll go on air and tell people, we need your help to move from being the old brand to the new brand, and you can help us redecorate effectively. And tens of thousands of listeners then jumped on our website, moderated these Virgin images off the website. And I think in less than 2 or 3 hours, this whole crossfade period that was pioneered by our creative agency out of Shoreditch called Albion London was all part of building that brand DNA, being very open and honest with our audience about it. And on the Friday before the Monday, I was in my office and I got a call from Adrian, and he said, I need to talk to you really urgently. We've been sued. by Absolut Vodka, and we now have to decide whether to take them to court and challenge their legal case, or whether we come up with a new name in 72 hours. I just couldn't believe it. It was like, you know, one of the darkest periods in my career. People that know me well know I'm an optimistic, positive person. And my wife says to me, you know, that you know, people have described someone as being half full or half empty. She goes, now you're always a three quarters full person. And I'm not sure that's always a compliment, by the way. But so I was determined to stay optimistic and positive. You know, we went into the weekend quite literally not knowing what to do. There's two things I needed to do. I needed to really think carefully about whether there was any basis of in their claims. I knew from the very moment that there wasn't. Now, we'd named Absolut Radio International in Adrian Robinson's garden in July 2001, 7 years before Absolut Radio came on air. We'd trademarked Absolut Radio in all of the classes and categories from that moment. Never once had we thought about it being connected with Absolut Vodka. Completely different category, completely different spelling. So I knew that this was, that we were right. We hadn't plagiarized, we hadn't done what they, and that was really important. You need to go, well, is there any basis in fact in what they're asserting? So that was one thing I needed to get really clear in my mind. And I was, you know, because we'd registered trademarks, URLs, it had been 7 years earlier, that meant that I could confidently look people in the eye as a manager and say, they are wrong, and we just hope the court agree with us. The second thing I needed to do was to speak to my board members who were effectively putting the money into the station and say, look, they're wrong, we're right. But you've put in the vast majority of equity into this business. You know what legal cases can do. It doesn't matter what I believe, and it's going to matter what a judge believes. And a judgment is going to take, you know, 18 months to 2 years and a couple of million pounds of legal fees, which is what it ended up costing. Do you back us? Times of India is owned by two brothers, Samir Jain and Vineet Jain. I had a really good, close working relationship with Vineet. And we just had the conversation just like where you and I have a conversation now. And he said, no, Clive, this is wrong what they're doing. We were very fortunate that Vineet was a man of means, and we fought it. And we settled out of court. Ultimately, Absolut Vodka is still called Absolut Vodka, and Absolut Radio is still called Absolut Radio. So you can interpret that as you wish. And it was a huge waste of lawyers' time, but in the end, logic and sense prevailed.
Okay, it's 7:41. This is a huge moment for us, is what we've all been waiting for years, I think, not just the last couple of months. The very next song you're going to hear will be the first song on A Bright Future for all of us here.
To be honest, we had much bigger problems than that came along. And those much bigger problems, of course, was the completely unravelling of the whole financial institution that happened literally a few weeks after that September launch.
There is no one country that can solve this crisis on its own.
I remember walking down Regent Street, November 2008. In Australia, we call it the GFC, the Global Financial Crisis. And I remember getting to Australia thinking, only Australia would give it a friendly acronym, right? Every single media business lost somewhere between 15 and 25% of revenues in like a week, which of course is insignificant now compared to the 30 to 70% of revenues that media companies have lost in the last 6 months. But as a privately owned small radio business, you know, we knew that we would lose audience through the transition because the way that Radar works, that the Virgin brand was always giving the business a halo. We knew it would take at least 2 years to build that audience back up, but we weren't able to forecast the GFC. Therefore, the loss of audience plus the loss of revenue that just came to everybody was particularly tough to deal with, which meant that So many of the things that we wanted to do just had to go on hold, you know. The absolute critical amount of television advertising that we needed to do to build the new brand just wasn't affordable anymore. So we had to use much smarter, smaller, and ultimately cheaper tactics to build the brand. Therefore, it took just that little bit longer to get back into that net positive audience period. We were immediately trying to chase our tails around making sure that we could equip the right amount of financial resources to keep the station operating and growing. And what we were very fortunate to do is that our Indian backers stayed with us through all of those hairy moments. The big difference was that in that 5 years, they wanted to acquire and develop other brands and become a bigger force. The GFC made it very hard for them to justify doing that in the UK economy. It had very little to do with UK radio economy and nothing to do with Absolute Radio, but it became pretty clear to them that the plans that they had with us to invest in British radio, European radio, and possibly Northern Hemisphere radio, because there's still a massive radio in India today, were not made possible by that 5 years of contraction. So that meant that if they couldn't expand beyond one then profitable radio business, and by the time they sold Absolute Radio, it was making decent profits again, they didn't want to hold, I understand that. And the three of us also, it's one of those crossroads again. It was like, what do I want to do now? I've ticked my box on digital media. I've ticked my box on international radio. I've got in the wings, the Jack business was continuing to grow really well. And I said, I'd like to exercise even more influence over Jack and grow Jack nationally and locally, which we've now done. And also I want to spend some time in the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, I wanted to spend some time in Asia Pacific and Southeast Asia. I've become almost too reliant on Northern Hemisphere and possibly one of the most experienced radio people in the market, and thinking, actually, is that what I want to define my career? With the advent of podcasting and music streaming already starting to grow by 2010, and we sort of pioneered a whole bunch of technologies like InStream and podcasts, and we were doing 11 million podcast downloads a month by 2011. You know, 10 years ago, 11 million a month under Paul Sylvester's leadership, amazing leadership. And radio, as we know it, is going to change. Audio on demand and music streaming is going to become a very big part of radio. I think I want to think ahead. I want to go to a different part of the world, get different experiences. And that was Australia. But I knew that we were in a tricky spot. And the most challenging thing of all was making sure that the people that had done the hard work were going to be looked after. And, you know, I'm thrilled to know now that super talented people like Paul Sylvester, Tony Morey, Cap Martin, Claire Baker, Paul Brown, Anthony Abbott, these are all Simon Kilby. These are all extremely influential senior leaders in the Barrow organization. And Dee and the team there recognized that. And that was, you know, right up there for me as a priority. The second priority was I felt very strongly about the importance and the value of the Absolute brand. And I don't mind admitting it, you know, I would do anything I could to ensure that that brand was maintained by someone who believed in it. Because there were many people around that time who were swarming, who just really wanted to buy the asset for the license, including potentially a return to that business being called Virgin Radio again. And I thought that would be the worst outcome of all. And yet again, Virgin is a great brand, and Virgin Radio has now returned as a great radio station. But One Golden Square had its Virgin journey, and Absolute hadn't even yet reached its full potential, as it now clocks up about 5 million reach. Linda, my wife, was born in Sydney. She's been on this rollercoaster journey with me from when we met in the mid-90s, the ups and downs. Her family was still in Sydney. I had some really good friends working at Austereo. And they said, well, you know, why don't you come over here? Australian radio industry is very sophisticated, probably up there with France, one of the most sophisticated radio markets in the world in broadcast terms. But what they needed in spades was somebody who could bring in digital strategy to these businesses. So she was extremely supportive because we'd been on this journey together as a family, and also it meant that she, having lived overseas for over 20 years, she got a chance to go home. And Southern Cross Stereo's revenues in 2014, when converted into pounds, were greater than the whole of UK commercial radio's revenues. This was like a radio business I'd never seen before. It reminded me of sort of Capital Group. So all the positives with that were it had an incredible talent, amazing resources, very little networking, apart from big shows like Hamish and Andy, networked for a reason.
Like, I think we have bonds that are deeper than you would ever maybe get with just a normal friendship, because we've kind of done this weird thing where we accidentally, our friendship kind of somehow became our job, which is an odd thing to go through.
For Australian radio, there are two, maybe even three day parts where personalities are required. And whereas in UK radio, typically we just have one and that's breakfast. I mean, when we were at Capital, Chris Tarrant was king. I was one of the few people that actually knew how much he got paid, and he was worth every pound and more. When I got to SCA in 2014, there were at least a half dozen people that were paid significantly more than Chris Tarrant ever earned. And they were in local radio, in cities that were half the size of London, because the industry takes a much larger share of all advertising, takes between sort of 6 and 10% of all advertising, depending on the market, whereas UK radio still to this day really only takes between sort of 4 and 6%. So there's more money. Commercial radio in Australia started in the 1920s. So therefore, they had actually grown up on commercial radio, whereas commercial radio in the UK, of course, started in the 70s. So a 50-year head start. Talk radio dominates in a way that tabloid media dominates in the UK. The number one radio stations in Sydney, Melbourne today are still AM talk stations. That means you've got to have personalities. Vast number of buildings and staff and salespeople. But because it was almost over-reliant on its broadcast business, therefore, I had a near blank piece of paper to create a complementary digital business inside a radio group. And we were launching InStream, we were launching podcasts. It was all of the one golden square ideas, but with a balance sheet and scale and audiences that where I could really let rip. And Australia is a very large economic market, but it's a tiny country in terms of population. If you do something a bit different, you get noticed. And we got noticed. And I got a call. His opening line on the phone to me was, "My name's Tim Warner. Everyone tells me you should be working for me." Which was very Australian, right? It was like, okay, what are you doing now? I said, "I'm working." And I said, "What are you doing?" "I'm working. Come and have a beer." Shot over to the other side of the city, sat in his office. At the time, Seven West Media was a huge multi-billion dollar company in radio, television, newspapers, magazines, and some digital investments. But they were the number one TV network. They were like ITV, like size and production business as well. But because they were so good at producing television content, their digital product wasn't as good as it should have been. So I went into my boss's office again at SCA and said, I think it's time for me to leave. And that was a hard conversation because SCA had paid for me to come over. They'd moved my family over. We had two fantastic, enjoyable years. And 2 years is quite a short spell for me to make an impact. But I knew immediately this opportunity at Seven was going to be a very big part of my life. And the movement from being audio and IP to being video and IP was something that I felt extremely passionate about. And the opportunity at Seven was to work on some of the biggest sporting events in the world and some of the most disruptive streaming technologies in the world in terms of competing with YouTube and Netflix for entertainment on demand streaming. My time in the 80s in Dunstable and the fact that I understood a little bit about technology and play out, and then involved in very early audio streaming at Capital, and a bit of a arms race with the then Virgin Radio to get the first audio stream up. And as you move up in audio quality, what's called fully lossless audio codec, FLAC, which is streaming at sort of 1.1 megabits per second, then actually the next stop is 1.5 megabits per second when you can stream video. And I realized that my streaming audio experience gave me this foundation for streaming video, because it's just the same. You're just encoding content. I reached another crossroads. The Seven West Media journey was hugely enjoyable. I launched a product called 7 Plus, which is, you know, number one or number two in the sort of free-to-air streaming marketplace. Thousands of hours, millions of users. Built a news website that had gone from zero to a 10 million monthly unique audience. And I was thinking about what's next. And Optus is the second biggest telco in the market. And a number of years earlier, I'd very audaciously stolen the English Premier League rights from the dominant Fox Sports in a sort of overnight dawn raid in those rights cycles. And they'd also got the World Cup rights. And during the 2018 Men's World Cup, I was at Seven and Optus were streaming the Women's World Cup. They had a crisis. The streaming platform they built couldn't sustain the vast numbers of streamers. And I got a call at Seven from the then CEO and said, how come I watch the Australian Open, the Commonwealth Games and the Winter Olympics on your product, and you know, hundreds of thousands of Australians enjoyed it, and my team can't deliver the same experience for the Men's World Cup? Can you come and help? They were in for a bumpy road. It was a huge negative PR moment for the company when, you know, the Prime Minister had to phone up Optus to say, why are you denying Australia of this spawning event? Bear in mind that was none of this content was on broadcast TV. And in the crisis, they actually had to effectively give the content to a free-to-air television channel so people could watch the football, because the streaming just wasn't working. So after the event, he said to me, well, what was the problem? I said, well, there's two problems. One problem is that your technology was insufficient and your team were ill-prepared for it. But the bigger problem is that culturally, you were not set up to deal with the importance of content inside the telecommunications with it, and you've underestimated the role of video streaming. I said, well, would you come and fix it for us? And I said, well, I'll only come if I can fix both. And I said, I'd like to be involved in all product creation around what I call today Future Core. And of course, I don't want to solely look after your content business. I'd like to look after your product business and your product development business. Because I think now, for the next 5 years of my career, even being defined as a streaming media expert is probably not something that fulfills my ambition enough. I want to be get involved in product, of which streaming video and streaming media is just one of the products. And he said, okay, well, I'll create a role for you to do that. And I look after a 5G home internet product, a smart home and smart spaces product, which I'm very passionate about. I think that's the next big movement. Is going to be around how we connect our homes through smart spaces. The things that are going to define the telecommunications industry for the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, looking at disruptive technologies around how consumers get connected.
New Optus Family Plan includes 4 SIMs and the McAfee Safe Family app.
I've been at Optus for 18 months. And of course, in February of this year, we're starting to make our plans around the role of video on our network. And I believe that the internet is almost solely a video or audio experience transport technology. And of course, then COVID hit, and all of a sudden the future came forward by 5 years. And whether you have every telehealth appointment now on Zoom, whether you have teaching your children with remote education, and then on top of that, people's growth in SVOD and AVOD, YouTube and Netflix streaming. I think in the space of 6 months, my prediction of this being video and audio experience world has become very true very quickly, and I find myself in this incredible position of being able to pioneer video and audio experience as part of one of the largest telco companies in the world in Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific, where we have across the whole of Asia Pacific, I get to work with amazing people who bring products to 700 million paying customers. And I sort of pinch myself to wonder how I got here. And in moments like this, I go, yeah, actually, I sort of know how I got here. A series of crossroads, decisions, people who have backed me, believed in me, and brought myself back from some pretty tough setback moments and been able to learn fast when I have failed to actually and make sure that I can bounce back and not make some of those same mistakes again. It's an amazing country, and I became an Australian about 18 months, 2 years ago. So I've got my Australian passport, my kids are Australian, my wife was obviously Australian anyway. And of course it's been a sort of sobering 6 months, because there are four places on earth where it is best to be from a safety perspective at the moment, and that is New Zealand, Western Australia, Queensland, or New South Wales. Those four regions and two countries are some of the safest places to be in terms of modest impact from COVID, much more measured impact on the economy. And actually, I consider myself to be very fortunate to be here. And I look at the news, and I look at what's happening in Europe, and it makes me extremely sad. This is quite a weird experience. I've never spoken to anyone about some of this stuff, not in one session anyway. I spoke to my wife and said, I'm doing this interview. And she went, what? You never do that. I said, I've got anecdotes and stories, but going through it from 1973 to 2021, never done it before, because I really don't look back very often. I very much look forward. In my opinion, my happiest moment is still in front of me. I see it really clearly. I have so much more I want to do. You know, I'm only 53 years old. I intend to work for at least another 20 odd years, and I've still got lots of things I want to achieve. I'm only wired to think that tomorrow is going to be better than yesterday. If you spend too much time thinking back, you limit your future.
Clive Dickens. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and do grab my book if you like radio memories. It's called Radio Moments, available on Amazon, looking at the last 50 years of radio through my own eyes, in very personal fashion. There's also another book, goodness, called Radio Secrets, which is all about techniques and in their quotes and expertise, insight from some of the leading brains in British radio programming. That book is called Radio Secrets.